Thank you, Dr. Fulner. Yes, no, I am not, perhaps to your detriment, I'm not Father Sirico, but to lessen the blow, they tried to maintain the O ending of the introducing speaker. So we at least kept the same ethnic category. Well, I'm greatly honored to speak before the Society today on such an important topic and among such distinguished company, including many old friends and some old friends, but those I had not yet met in person. I want to thank Bill Campbell and the Society's trustees and officers for the invitation. In particular, I want to note what a great pleasure it was to hear yesterday Brad Berzer, whom I met in person for the first time. I can hardly hesitate by offering the title Great Brad Berzer after that great talk last night. And I really would commend to everybody his forthcoming book on Kirk. I think the great taste of which we had last night. Kirk has been among one of my formative intellectual influences, not only through his own work, but through an introduction to the wider Western tradition that I know many of you have also experienced because of him. Like Dr. Berzer, I too drafted a letter to Dr. Kirk after reading The Conservative Mind. Perhaps more brazenly than Berzer, I sent it. And we struck up a correspondence until I got a chance to meet him at the Heritage Foundation in 1991, hard to believe. And through the good graces of that foundation, I was able to spend some time at Piety Hill in 1995 writing an essay that would ultimately result in a book on Kirk. And I have the privilege now of editing the University Bookman and working closely with Annette Kirk, who I think it's fair to say has done more than anyone else in keeping his memory and work alive. And so I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you briefly on America and the Permanent Things before I introduce Dr. Hancock. As this audience well knows, for Kirk, the Permanent Things were those enduring truths of human existence, which direct both the order of the soul and the order of the commonwealth. There are, he wrote, certain permanent things in society, the health of the family, inherited political institutions that ensure a measure of order and justice and freedom, a life of diversity and independence, a life marked by widespread possession of private property. These permanent things guarantee against arbitrary interference by the state. But they do more than this. Quoting T.S. Eliot, Kirk wrote that these permanent things were those elements in the human condition that give us our nature, without which we are the beasts that perish. These permanent things are reflected in different political and social arrangements. In America, as Ed said, we are blessed with the tradition of ordered liberty, whose bases stretch back in an institutional sense to the British experience of politics and government. The American colonies, as we heard earlier today, were steeped in the British experience and British practice, not least the strong tradition of the common law and the use of British precedent and legal treatises. These still hold true in many ways, certainly at the state and local levels. There are also national structural features, like the bicameral legislature, political parties, whom Kirk wrote in depth about, the presidential cabinet, and the primary system. And of course, there was the written constitution itself, with its guarantee of traditional British liberties. So much for the order of the Commonwealth, but what about the order of the soul? For such political arrangements were not sufficient for Kirk. Political structures or economic systems do not last forever. They change, and they often change in response to underlying shifts in the values and virtues of the people. Being wedded to old customs for their own sake is unfortunately perhaps not a viable strategy. And although the degeneration of politics, an example of which perhaps we're seeing in DC these last few days, can be visible evidence of decline, a political solution to that decline can by its nature only be temporary. And one of the lessons I think we can learn from the what I'll call the new Kirk scholarship from people like Brad and Wes MacDonald and James Person and others is that Kirk was showing conservatives and others that we must go deeper into what the American Catholic writer Orestes Bronson, whom Kirk quoted on this point, called the unwritten constitution. Indeed, Kirk was so convinced of the superiority of this unwritten constitution to that of the written that he wrote that, quote, no matter how admirable a constitution may look upon paper, it will be ineffectual unless the unwritten constitution, the web of custom and convention, affirms an enduring moral order of obligation and personal responsibility. The most important source, I think, of that unwritten constitution in America is Christianity. Chris Kopp, I think, touched on that earlier today. In a 1983 lecture, so 30 years ago, Kirk claimed that the particular forms of Anglo-American law reflect, even if opaquely, Christian assumptions about the nature of man. Without those assumptions, among which is the recognition that politics cannot control the entirety of human existence and experience, the legal system will be used merely as a tool for social engineering and judicial metaphysics. Kirk often lamented the rise of the archonocracy, I'm not sure if he coined it, but which he used to describe the rule by judges. Now, in making this point, Kirk is not saying that the United States is a Christian commonwealth or one whose legal code need match the Christian moral code point for point. Indeed, he stated in a lecture that the state is unconcerned with sin unless it leads to breaches of the peace or a menace to the social order. And certainly the rise of the modern administrative state is quite removed from the postulates of human nature Kirk thought should inform lawmaking. But rather, Kirk is making an historical point that our legal system comes from a very specific tradition that is ignored at our peril. Echoing Christopher Dawson, Kirk knew that every society has its beliefs and taboos, acts that are honored, and those that bring shame. A culture that is rooted in the transcendent, unlike one that is not, knows the limits of politics. And without such knowledge, there's no limit to the power of the state upon its subjects. And we see that, I think, in recent acts from Washington that attempt to convert the freedom to exercise one's religious belief to really just the freedom to worship, as long as it's closed doors without a public presence. But what about other pieces of that web of custom and convention? Conservatives, I think Kirk would argue, need to spend more time focused on identifying and nurturing those pieces in addition to their efforts at practical political reform. This may not be easy. First, as Brad said last night, Kirk was not a speculative or systematic thinker, and he was opposed to ideological uniformity of any kind. His own writing, I believe, was constructed in a discursive narrative style that so enraged his critics, precisely because he knew that at the heart of life was a mystery, and the attempt to reduce that mystery to a party platform or set of theses was doomed to failure. He did not, for example, and I looked, although Brad in his letters may have found such a list, I could not find, for example, a list of those customs and conventions Kirk thought worth preserving. That would be perhaps too much of ideological dogmata for him. That is for us to identify, though in his books and short stories, Kirk illustrated through individual example good men and women who are doing just that. Second, to preserve tradition or that custom of the web of custom and convention, while not anti-political, has a little explicit connection to politics. He wrote that traditions are not created by political authority and ought not to be debased into party slogans. So I think it's important in that context, as we consider the conservative mind, to note the person who bookends that great book. He starts, of course, with Edmund Burke, but he ends with T.S. Eliot, about whom Kirk wrote a separate and, frankly, I think, thrilling and one of the best of his books. Eliot was no politician, of course, and in traditional poetic terms was a revolutionary. He burst a literature that had gone stale and found a new way to write poetry, all in the service of the permanent things, but different from his predecessors. Conservatives, I think, need to identify our Eliots today. Who are those poets, architects, writers, filmmakers who are redeeming the time in their own corner of the world? These people, and perhaps not the politicians, who will, as Chris Kopp reminded us this morning, they're the ones who should be encouraged to write our story. This exercise in recovery may not deliver clear political rewards, but nor will it convert the lived American experience, the one that Wilmore Kendall said we lived in our hips, into an ideology. Instead, it can provide the foundation for a true diversity and freedom of choice, words debased perhaps by an abstract leftism now, but which Kirk himself identified as American traditions. And indeed, Kirk went so far as to say that, quote, "I have not the slightest idea of what the American way of life in the abstract may be," close quote. Shocking words, perhaps, at least to me when I first read them, but Kirk, I think, was signaling something important to us. Conservatives need to foster and create those particulars in our own communities and through our own individual stories and acts. They can protect us against the brutal uniformity of ideology, no matter who is in control of Congress or the White House. And in this vein, in addition to the great website that Winston Elliott and his colleagues have put up, The Imaginative Conservative. I noticed Bill Kaufman was invoked earlier today, and I'd refer you to his work for a one-man fight to recreate a true American regionalism. For Kirk, therefore, political problems are not simply disputes over particular policies, but deep disagreements about how to order our common life reflect deeper philosophical and theological problems. In that book that was mentioned, I've called Kirk's approach to this problem a postmodern one, not in the sense of espousing a moral relativism, but rather an approach that recognized that rationalism itself and its current, either of the Enlightenment or its current descendant, could not solve the most important social and political problems. Instead, Kirk looked to an age that he wrote, quote, may also be a time of renewed poetic imagination and of the reflection of poetry in politics, of a, quote, reaffirmed poetic vision of the splendor and misery of the human condition. Kirk's stress on recognizing the transcendent and the limits this places on the political order brings us to our speaker today. Dr. Hancock teaches political science at Brigham Young University and is the author of numerous articles and books, including The Responsibility of Reason, Theory and Practice in a Liberal Democratic Age. He's also president of the John Adams Center for the Study of Faith, Philosophy, and Public Affairs. In some postings on the First Things website, Dr. Hancock wrote that reason must confront, quote, the problematic articulations of transcendence generated in man's practical existence, religious, family, and political. He goes on to say that reason, quote, will have to learn to show the connections between the indefinable freedom of the human spirit and the humbler necessities of our natures as being dependent upon family, community, and polity. But to do this, he continues, to take responsibility for connecting our theoretical freedom with our practical belonging, reason would first have somehow to learn to see its own goodness in the light of a transcendence it can never adequately name. I think wording that evokes certainly what Kirk was trying to do in some of his writings. This elevation of reason derived from a kind of Lockeanism to the detriment of those family and religious and community loyalties has been a very prominent theme here in the United States. I hope that Dr. Hancock today can shed some light on a way out of this dilemma. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hancock up to the podium.